Her family's accumulation of wealth, even while she has risen to power championing attacks on corporate America, has been deeply dependent on those same corporations. Indeed, she effectively leveraged her position working as a government consultant in the 1990s on bankruptcy issues to reap a rich financial harvest as a legal consultant for the biggest corporations in America. And her family has benefited from other corporate ties. The fundamental contradictions between what she presents herself to be and what she has done provide for remarkable contrasts. Elizabeth Warren was born in Oklahoma, the daughter of Donald Herring and Pauline Reed Herring. Financial instability clouded her childhood, she recalls, and there was little encouragement to pursue academic achievement. She recounted vividly later in life the repossession of her family's station wagon. She was not the best student, but excelled at speech and forensics. That led to a debate scholarship to attend George Washington University and a way out. Marriage to a high school sweetheart cut short her undergraduate studies at George Washington, and she moved with Jim Warren to Houston, where she finished her studies at the University of Houston. It was a traditional life. She did her studies and had two children, daughter Amelia and son Alex. She was interested in law, and when her husband took the family to New Jersey, she enrolled at Rutgers University Law School and graduated with a J.D. Growing up in the Warren household, her daughter Amelia recalls a tightly run ship, including a dinner table with napkin rings with our names on them that made it clear who was supposed to sit where. In 1978, Warren and her husband split up. She began seeing Professor Bruce Mann, who was teaching at the University of Connecticut. Warren and Mann taught law at the University of Houston and then moved to the University of Texas in 1983. She continued to move up the ladder of the university system. By 1987, both she and Bruce had moved to the University of Pennsylvania Law School. She was now in the Ivy League. The story of Elizabeth Warren's academic success cannot be divorced from her claimed status as a Native American. They are deeply intertwined. Barely 1 year before her appointment to the University of Pennsylvania faculty, Warren began to list herself as a minority Native American law professor in the directory of the Association of American Law Schools. Her claim as a Native American, she would later say, was based on family lore about their ancestry. When it became an issue during her 2012 Senate campaign, she turned up a great-great-great-grandmother who was designated as Cherokee in an online ancestry posting of a marriage license back in 1894. In 2018, she took a DNA test that demonstrated that she had some Native American DNA. If her account is true, she is, at a maximum, 1/32nd Native American. If, however, the heritage she claims was a few generations further back, she is as little as 1/1024th Native American. Warren says that she claimed Native American status in the directories not to benefit her career, but instead, "I listed myself in the directory in the hopes that it might mean that I would be invited to a luncheon, a group, something that might happen with people who are like I am." But there is no record at Texas, Penn, or Harvard that she joined any groups or organizations that would bring her in contact with people who are like I am. Furthermore, the directory is used explicitly to make diversity-friendly hires, something that Warren undoubtedly would have known. Warren, by declaring herself a Native American law professor, was a rare find for the University of Pennsylvania. They made a point of publicizing her alleged ethnic roots. The law school's federal affirmative action reports listed a sole Native American female professor, presumably Warren, while she taught there. Penn's Minority Equity Report, for example, identified her as an ethnic minority. At Penn, she caught the attention of Harvard. They recruited her, offering Warren an endowed chair position on the faculty, the Leo Gottlieb Professor of Law, that would make her the third highest person on the payroll at Harvard. Her recruitment to Cambridge came at a time when Harvard Law School was under intense pressure to diversify its faculty with more minorities. Harvard contends that she was not hired because of her claimed ethnic background. As the University of Pennsylvania had done, Harvard was eager to tout her as a minority recruit. A Harvard University spokesman described her as Harvard Law School's first woman of color. She was repeatedly identified as an example of minority hiring at Harvard Law. Harvard Law School currently has only one tenured minority woman, Gottlieb Professor of Law Elizabeth Warren, who is Native American, noted the Harvard Crimson. But something curious happened after Warren secured her new position at Harvard Law School. She stopped listing herself in the directory as a minority the same year Harvard hired her to a tenured position. A corporate law firm named Cleary Gottlieb funded her endowed chair. They set up the chair to honor one of the firm's founding partners, a Harvard graduate. Cleary Gottlieb is a global firm that counts foreign governments and multinational corporations as its most lucrative clients. The firm specialized in commercial and financial law, representing a variety of corporate firms and Wall Street investment houses. In addition to funding her chair, Warren also credited them with providing funds for research on various writing projects. As we will see, her ties to Cleary Gottlieb spilled over into her roles as a government official. While at Harvard, Warren taught classes in stately red sandstone law buildings like Austin Hall, with its Romanesque architecture and graceful arches. But her teaching load was light, affording her other opportunities to generate income, many of which seemed to contradict her 2008 public persona. Oklahoma's economy is heavily tied to energy prices and has experienced booms and busts over the decades. A depressed energy market meant that jobs were scarce and real estate values were down. People lost their homes, unable to pay their mortgages. It was the sort of economic calamity and hardship for the middle class about which Warren has eloquently spoken. In her books, she wrote about victims of the housing bust. But Warren and her husband took advantage of the economic tumult, buying foreclosed properties at rock-bottom prices and then flipping them for profit. Warren knew what she was talking about when she later wrote a book titled The Fragile Middle Class, noting that foreclosures are notorious for fetching low prices. In all, the two law professors worked to supplement their income and net worth through a number of real estate deals that netted the family serious profits once they flipped the homes. Warren and her husband bought properties in their own names, but they also financed the purchase of properties by her relatives. In those instances, she charged her family high interest rates for her investment. For example, in June 1993, they purchased a foreclosed home from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, for $61,000, and then sold it 18 months later for a 56% profit. In another instance, they bought a house on Northwest 16th Street in August 1993 for just $30,000. 5 months later, they sold it for $145,000, a 383% gain. In all, over the course of 15 years, Warren either purchased or financed $1.2 million in real estate deals, according to Oklahoma real estate records. Warren and her husband were engaging in the sort of profit-making activity that is certainly legitimate, but also ironic, given that their profit margin was at times predicated on the financial misfortune of others. In short, for herself, she was comfortable with the sort of economic behavior for which she would later famously condemn others. Warren, like many law professors, had the opportunity to seek additional sources of income beyond her already high salary. In the mid-1990s, Warren began advising the U.S. Congress on bankruptcy laws. It was her academic specialty, and by 1995, she was tapped to advise the National Bankruptcy Review Commission, which had been set up by Congress to rewrite U.S. laws. In a 2002 court document, she would explain the role she played. "I provided assistance to various congressional staff people, tried to help them understand the issues involved, and to evaluate the various statutory proposals as they arose. She was also a key advisor on an obscure but profoundly important section of the bankruptcy law called USC 524G, which dealt with mass tort bankruptcies of corporations and had to do specifically with asbestos companies, but had broad ramifications for other corporations as well. Could large companies who were facing class action lawsuits because of defective products shield themselves from these legal claims by declaring bankruptcy? How would corporate bankruptcies and the money owed to legal claimants be handled? Large corporations stand to gain or lose a lot based on how these bankruptcy laws are written." As Warren recounted in a legal brief involving a later corporate bankruptcy, "When the commission formed working groups, I assisted the mass tort group, supervised the research on the subject, developed an agenda to consider mass tort issues, prepared a number of position papers, invited witnesses and participants to commission meetings, and helped craft a proposal that was ultimately adopted unanimously by the commissioners." In short, Warren was at ground zero in rewriting corporate bankruptcy laws. The revisions to the laws that she helped to pen had enormous positive ramifications for America's largest corporations. The new laws allowed financially healthy corporations to start using bankruptcies as a way to avoid liability from legal suits. As the New York Times explained, the new laws pushed by Warren led Fortune 500 companies with otherwise solid balance sheets to use the bankruptcy courts as part of a broad strategy to resolve potentially ruinous legal woes. The new bankruptcy laws were a big win for large corporations, from asbestos producers to manufacturers of breast implants. Warren's role in writing these new rules created enormous financial opportunities for her. With large corporations still being sued, she was positioned to provide legal advice and services to those same companies for a high fee. Who better for them to hire than the person who helped to write the new laws? It was the ultimate Washington leverage move. Warren was walking a well-worn self-enrichment path in the nation's capital, whereby the people who write the rules interpret those same rules in order to use them for their benefit. What makes Warren's case unusual is that she has continued to insist that she is an outsider, not part of the madding crowd in Washington who were cashing in on public service and leveraging it for profit. Warren claims that she has been consistent for years in her advocacy for families and workers. "I've been out there working for families," she said when asked about her legal work in 2012. "I've been out there working for people who've been injured by big corporations. I've been out there working for people who've been injured by asbestos. I've been doing that for years and years and years." But a detailed examination of her legal consulting record shows otherwise. Indeed, of the known cases where she did legal consulting, her work on a number of those cases was on behalf of major corporations. Each of these companies was facing major liability involving pensions or class action lawsuits, which she helped them avoid. She was extremely well compensated. In a legal brief, she described her customary billing rate as $700 per hour back in 2002. Today, in 2019, that equates to about $996 per hour. Let us consider what she was paid to do and who was paying her. In one of her earliest cases, Warren represented corporations seeking release from a law that required them to pay health benefits to coal miners. One of those clients was LTV Steel, which was trying to overturn a court ruling that required the company to pay its former employees and dependents $140 million in retirement benefits. LTV was trying to avoid its responsibilities under the 1992 Coal Act, which established a fund to pay retired coal workers. The appellate court sided against Warren's clients, and Warren filed a brief with the Supreme Court seeking to overturn the decision. The Supreme Court never took up the case. Warren argued that since LTV Steel was coming out of bankruptcy, it should not have to pay into the coal fund. Mine workers, of course, were opposed to her position, fearing that if LTV did not pay its fair share, it would allow other coal companies to get out of their obligations. "That's what the people who didn't want to pay always wanted to say," said Peter Buscemi, a lawyer who represented the retirees in the case. "They wanted to say someone else will pay and the benefits won't be in jeopardy. But if one employer doesn't pay, then another, and then another, then who knows what will happen?" When asked publicly about her work on the LTV matter, Warren tried to obscure her role in the case, arguing through a spokesperson that she was simply standing up for bankruptcy principles. In 2006, she actually gave an interview with the Public Broadcasting System, or PBS, where she attacked the company for treating employees like paper towels. "You use them and you throw them away." She never disclosed in that interview that the company paid her to help them avoid some of their liabilities. Warren was paid $10,000 for her work, but she was just getting started. In the same PBS interview, Warren tried to distance herself from the rules she had helped write. Now, after she had made large sums of money helping corporations, she denounced the rules. "Congress wrote the rules, and the rules say the employees don't come first." She wanted new rules quite different from those she had helped to write a decade earlier and that had benefited her financially. "What we need is a new set of rules that does not permit corporations to put their short-term immediate profits ahead of the employees that have invested in these businesses for 20 and 30 years." However, she continued to represent corporations in bankruptcy proceedings even after this interview. Warren also did legal work for Fairchild Aircraft Corporation, or FAC, which produced small aircraft. The company went into bankruptcy in 1990, and a group of investors bought it and formed Fairchild Acquisition Incorporated, or FAI. The asset purchase was supposed to be free and clear of any liabilities. In 1995, the families, estates, and/or businesses of four people who had died tragically in a plane crash sued FAC and FAI. The victims' families believed that the aircraft was defectively manufactured by FAC. FAC hired Warren to argue to a Texas court that the families could not legitimately sue the companies. The bankruptcy court rejected her legal theory. Warren claims that her motive in defending the company was to save jobs. In fact, though, the company hired her to protect their assets, not jobs. Their worry was that the case would affect future claims that others might have against them. In addition, there is no evidence to indicate that the suit would result in lost jobs. Instead, she essentially argued that these families did not have legal recourse against these companies. Warren's legal consulting work radically contradicts the claims she makes that she is a fighter for the middle class and against corporate America. Indeed, she was well compensated for more than a decade providing legal testimony for corporations attempting to avoid pension obligations and paying victims. Consider the work Warren did as a legal consultant for Southwest Electric Power Company, a utility in Louisiana. A large power company wanted to shut down a rural energy cooperative, Cajun Electric Power, and acquire its major asset, a large coal-fired electric plant. When asked about her work for the utility during her 2012 Senate campaign, Warren claimed that she represented a company that offered a plan to help save a bankrupt rural power cooperative. The opposite was true, according to a New Orleans lawyer involved in the case. The power company was looking to use bankruptcy to liquidate the rural cooperative. As a bankruptcy expert, she provided legal assistance. In 1995, Warren also provided expert legal advice to Dow Chemical. The chemical giant owned 50% of Dow Corning, which was in a bankruptcy case. The bankruptcy followed lawsuits involving reportedly faulty silicone breast implants causing health problems. Dow was seeking to shield itself from taking any responsibility. As law professor William Jacobson of Cornell University puts it, in the early days of the Dow Corning breast implant litigation, Elizabeth Warren was providing legal advice to Dow Chemical, which was denying liability and would be fighting breast implant claims for many years to come. As one lawyer involved in the case put it, Warren's expertise was used by a company fighting in court to limit its liability and payments to women. Her involvement in the Dow case is clearly something she has tried to avoid having in the public light. During her 2012 campaign for the U.S. Senate, Warren avoided including the Dow case in a list of her legal consulting work that she provided to the media. In 2009, she defended insurance giant Travelers against the claims of asbestos victims. Travelers was fighting to gain immunity from some asbestos-related lawsuits by establishing a $500 million trust for victims, but on the precondition that other insurers would give up their claims against Travelers. Warren worked to protect the settlement for victims that other insurance companies would invalidate if they were able to retain their claims. Travelers avoided paying the $500 million settlement by losing the fight with the other insurers. Warren claimed that she was working on behalf of asbestos workers, but her client was the insurance giant. They were paying her fee for advice on protecting their interests. For her services, Travelers paid Warren a whopping $212,000. As Professor Jacobson puts it, Warren got paid, Travelers got to keep its settlement money, and the asbestos workers were left out in the cold. Her husband, Bruce Mann, a law professor who focuses on bankruptcy in American history, also did legal work on the case. According to the couple's 2009 financial disclosure, Travelers paid him an undisclosed sum. Warren worked similarly with Armstrong World Industries, a massive producer of wall and ceiling products for construction, which was also dealing with asbestos liabilities. The company used a reorganization plan to establish a trust and avoid direct payments to asbestos claimants. Warren was their paid consultant, and she helped them navigate Rule 524G, which she had helped to write. Warren's legal consulting work was on behalf of large corporations who were using bankruptcy laws or bankruptcy trusts to avoid liabilities. Much of Warren's legal work for these large corporations came through the white shoe corporate law firm Kaplan & Drysdale, which represented a myriad of large corporations who were going through bankruptcies. Warren often provided legal advice to the corporations, which meant that her ethical and legal obligations were to look out for the interests of the corporation, not their employees or claimants. Warren did do some legal work for nonprofit organizations such as AARP, formerly the American Association of Retired Persons. She also served as a consultant for lawyers who were suing major corporations. In all, most of her work outside Harvard was for the benefit of large corporate clients, and her corporate work provided the bulk of her legal income. Warren's regular and lucrative work for major corporations continued even as she sought to position herself as a consumer advocate. Along with her daughter Amelia, she co-wrote two books that presented a more populist view of the economy. The first book, The Two Income Trap, argued that middle-class couples, even with two incomes, had a hard time getting ahead. A key part of the problem was real estate prices, driven up by families looking to live in neighborhoods with good schools. The declining quality of public education had pushed up the price of housing in the best school districts, they argued. Parents had to overextend themselves to get a good education for their kids. The most radical solution they offered in the book was providing each family with a voucher that would allow parents to send their children to any public school, regardless of where they lived. It would be, they said, a shock to the educational system. But the competition would be good, and it would allow parents to take control over schools' tax dollars. Despite her claims to be a consumer advocate, Warren's legal work for large corporations was helping to make both her and her husband rich. Financial disclosures by the time she ran for the Senate in 2012 showed that her net worth was as much as $14.5 million. Her house alone was worth $5 million. The couple's investment stock portfolio was worth as much as $8 million, according to her own disclosures. Yet she steadfastly insisted that she was not wealthy. "I realize there are some wealthy individuals, I'm not one of them, but some wealthy individuals who have a lot of stock portfolios," she told MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell. A peek inside the couple's investment portfolio also contradicts her public persona as a liberal reformer and populist. While Warren has been downright brutal in her criticisms of major corporations from Wall Street to the healthcare industry, the couple has the bulk of her wealth invested in the very same companies, Fortune 500 and other traditional corporations. In 2008, for example, Warren and her husband held between $1 million and $5 million in global equities through their TIAA CREF retirement fund and another $500,000 to $1 million in a Vanguard 500 index fund. They had no investments in socially responsible investment funds. At the same time, Warren's husband also held an interest in a gas well in Latimer County, Oklahoma. Warren was teaching at Harvard Law School when the financial quake of 2008 struck. The financial crisis jolted even Harvard Law, with its massive endowment and storied halls. With the stock market plunging, the Harvard endowment was down 30%, although it was still tens of billions of dollars. In 2009, Harvard Law School officials had some financial decisions to make. The choice came down to salary reductions for the high-paid faculty or letting low-level employees at the law school go. Warren made $349,375 in 2009. Reportedly, a petition was circulated among Harvard Law faculty that called for salary reductions to save jobs. When job cuts came, Harvard trimmed the staff by 10%. Harvard Magazine noted that faculty and senior administration members had agreed to waive some compensation to help with the job cuts, but according to Warren's tax returns, she did not waive any compensation. Warren's salary actually went up in 2009. In her memoirs, Warren recounts how tight she is with her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi and how they have worked so closely together. Having written two books together, they are certainly still in regular communication. Supporters acknowledge that mother and daughter are not just close personally, but they are also long-time accomplices professionally. While Elizabeth Warren moved from Harvard academic to government official and U.S. senator, Amelia has been involved in a business venture that has run parallel to her mother's career like railroad tracks. As Warren came to play a central role in the regulation of the financial industry in the Obama administration, her daughter was seeking and securing partnerships and deals with some of those same investment firms. As Warren served in the U.S. Senate, she would take curious positions on a number of issues that would seem to benefit her daughter's corporate clients. The integrated relationship between Warren and her daughter is made apparent during a critical turning point in Warren's career. In November 2008, then-Professor Warren was at home in the evening when Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid called on the phone. Financial markets were in turmoil and Congress was in the process of creating mechanisms to inject huge sums of money into financial institutions. Reid had never met Warren before, but he knew her by reputation. He had read her book, The Two-Income Trap. Congress was setting up a 5-member congressional oversight panel to keep track of the government bailout that would make available $700 billion to investment banks and other financial institutions. Reid asked her to come to the Capitol to discuss the possibility of her serving as the chair. Warren agreed to meet, and then she asked Amelia to join her in Washington. Amelia was the co-founder of a business in 2007 called the Business Talent Group, or BTG, and she was in search of capital investors, board members, clients, and partners. As Reid later recalled, Warren came down to D.C. and met me with her daughter and did the deal. Warren became chair of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, Oversight Committee, which played a central role in the federal government's bailout of financial firms. Time magazine described Warren as a new sheriff in town who wielded her clout like a cudgel. Warren would hold highly publicized hearings, offer advice to Congress on the oversight program, and call out large financial institutions and Treasury Department officials. Warren turned her committee into a tough prosecutorial committee and issued blunt monthly reports demanding more accountability from banks. At the same time that Elizabeth Warren was meeting and talking with major Wall Street investment firms, her daughter's firm, BTG, was adding high-profile advisors with connections to the same companies who would benefit and face possible scrutiny from TARP. According to BTG's website in late 2008, these included Robert A. Kindler, Global Head of Mergers and Acquisitions at Morgan Stanley, former Global Head of M&A at J.P. Morgan Chase. Ironically, Kindler boasted a vanity license plate for his Porsche that read, "Too Big to Fail." Morgan Stanley would receive $10 billion from TARP. Edward J. Mathias, Managing Director at the Carlyle Group, former member of Management Committee and Board of Directors at T. Rowe Price. The Carlyle Group grabbed $145 million in TARP funds for an affiliate. William I. Jacobs, former Senior Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at MasterCard International. Amelia founded BTG along with business partner Jody Greenstone Miller. The company is essentially a temp firm for specialized and highly skilled employees. BTG proudly positions itself as a mechanism for the gig economy, where people are hired for part-time jobs rather than full-time employment. As Miller put it in the Wall Street Journal, "The surge in temp hiring is not a sign of a malfunctioning economy. It is the face of the future." Curiously, this business model runs totally contrary to Senator Warren's positions. Warren has been highly critical of the gig economy, arguing that part-time workers rarely get the benefits or the workplace authority that they would as full-time employees. In its early years, the firm struggled. Executives admitted that they had to be extremely resourceful in order to find new business. Executive recruitment and the temp business are largely about corporate connections. As Claire Malone of the Daily Beast pointed out, BTG is a hybrid headhunting and consulting firm, industries whose bread and butter is leveraging connections. Now they appeared to have some in abundance. In 2009, BTG had 200 people in its talent pool available for hire, just $4 million in revenue, and only one salesperson. By 2012, BTG had 1,800 independent professionals in the network and almost tripled the revenue at over $11 million. As we will see, they were doing business with some of the largest corporations in the country, as well as government agencies. From chair of the TARP Oversight Committee, Warren moved to the White House in September 2010 when President Obama appointed her as assistant to the president and special advisor to the Secretary of the Treasury. Her new job focused on setting up a consumer protection bureau. In the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, the mortgage meltdown, and all the instability that went with it, there was a natural appeal for such a bureau. President Obama and congressional Democrats were soon on board. Because it had been Warren's idea, she was the natural person to play a central role in establishing the organization and running it. The new $550 million agency would have enormous power. It was created to enforce rules on banks, collection agencies, Wall Street brokerage firms, credit unions, payday lenders, student loan servicers, and others. As the Treasury Secretary at the time, Timothy Geithner, put it, "It got the authority to write and enforce consumer rules for much of the financial system." Warren was eager to establish direct lines of communication with the executives of the most powerful financial firms in the country. Her first assignment to one staffer, Will Seeley, was collecting the cell phone number for every Wall Street CEO. In her new role, Warren was publicly blunt and aggressive when describing corporate America and the failures of corporate executives. Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors and acting like we should thank them, she said during her speech at the Democratic National Convention in August 2012. Does anyone here have a problem with that? However, privately, she offered a softer, more friendly tone in her communications with the large Wall Street firms. Indeed, she seemed eager to work with the same titans that she was lambasting in public. "You all gave us a great deal to think about, and we are all appreciative," she wrote to Richard Davis, the president and CEO of U.S. Bancorp, in a March 2011 email obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. "I value your help and your friendship more than you know." Communication with the CEOs of major Wall Street firms was in stark contrast to the battle that was waged in public. Warren has met in private with Wall Street moguls that she publicly criticizes. This duality in her public utterances and private tone continued well into her tenure in the U.S. Senate. In July 2017, she joined a private donor retreat held at the Martha's Vineyard home of Robert Wolf, the former UBS Investment Bank CEO. Wolf told the New York Times, "I think she is very different in a conversation than when she's on the stump." She also held private meetings with J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon. In public, she has excoriated Dimon and pointedly asked for his resignation from the New York Federal Reserve Bank's board of directors. Elizabeth Warren's softer tone in private occurred while her daughter Amelia was building BTG. Warren's daughter Amelia is married to Sushil Tyagi, who moved to the United States from India after studying civil engineering in Delhi. Amelia and Sushil met at Wharton Business School while pursuing their MBAs. Sushil had been in the United States for a while and had studied at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science and the University of California at Berkeley. Sushil Tyagi is a somewhat mysterious figure. He is generally media shy and appears in few publicly available Warren family photographs, and he enjoys business ties in India and elsewhere that are hard to trace. Elizabeth Warren is close to Sushil. She mentions him on her website and credits him in the acknowledgments of the book she wrote with Amelia called All Your Worth, stating, "Sushil Tyagi offered tremendous support and intelligent insight." Warren recounts in her memoir attending Sushil's brother's wedding in India, but offers scant information about the Tyagi family. Indeed, finding details about Tyagi's background is quite difficult. Warren and her husband, Bruce Mann, also have some familiarity with Sushil's business activities. In December 2009, they served as witnesses for a power of attorney corporate document he filed in India. Since his marriage into the Warren family, Sushil has been involved in a series of curious, even troubling, business ventures around the world. Tyagi runs Tricolor Films, which formerly boasted a small website with few details of his activities. In 2004, he was an executive producer on an Indian film called Hari Om, produced with a company called Tips Industries, which is run by Kumar and Ramesh Taurani. The two brothers are well known in Indian film circles. In 1997, Ramesh was accused of hiring a hitman to take out a film rival named Gulshan. But Sushil Tyagi has demonstrated a willingness to work with global bad actors in business ventures. Tyagi was the producer on a 2008 film funded by the Iranian government. The film was called The Song of Sparrows and was directed by Iranian filmmaker Majid Majidi. The film's synopsis: after being let go from his job on an ostrich farm, a man leaves his small village to find work in the big city. As a motorcycle taxi driver, he soon becomes consumed with his passengers' lives and is swept up in a world of greed. Now it is up to his family back home to help restore his caring and generous nature. A New York Times review of the film called it Majidi's most religious film released in the United States. On April 8, 2009, Sushil Tyagi was listed as the sole producer in the credits for The Song of Sparrows on the New York Times film page. Now his entry on the New York Times film page has been removed. Tyagi's connection to the Iranian government came at a troublesome time for U.S.-Iranian relations. Washington had accused Iran of assisting in the killing of five American soldiers based in Iraq. The country's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, had repeatedly threatened that the United States, which he declared a satanic power, and warned that Israel would disappear from the face of the earth. The full credits of the film, for some reason, seem to also have been scrubbed from the internet. We obtained a copy by using the Wayback Machine and made a startling discovery. The movie's chief investors included none other than the social deputy of the State Welfare Organization, or SWO, of Iran, as well as the Cultural and Artistic Organization of Tehran. These two investors in the film might appear at first glance to be innocuous cultural organizations, but they are not. Both are funded and controlled by the Islamist Iranian government. The Cultural and Artistic Organization of Tehran states, "This organization was founded in 1996 and does its activities under the supervision of a board of trustees composed of various cultural institutions such as IRIB and Islamic Propaganda Organization. Their homepage promotes several events, like one for school children entitled The Seal of Hostages, attended by several top Iranian officials. Another event that this cultural organization promotes is the inherently anti-Semitic Quds Day on the last day of Ramadan. The Cultural and Artistic Organization of Tehran openly acknowledges that they organize marches and create the posters, cartoons, and caricatures for Quds Day. They write, "A new plan for the destruction of Israel will be launched, and the Quds cultural radio station will be located at the radio station. Also, the I Love the Fight Against Israel is distributed among the people." Quds Day typically features massive crowds organized by the Iranian government chanting "Death to America" and burning effigies, with full media coverage. The film credits for Sushil's The Song of Sparrows read like a who's who of prominent Iranian government institutions. They include a thank you to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Air Force. Sushil Tyagi also produced another film by Majid Majidi called Nava Ashoreh. Even less information is available about this film than for The Song of Sparrows. A now-shut-down webpage describes Sushil's production company this way: "Leveraging their relationships with studio executives, access to top creative talent, and the high-level support that they enjoy from numerous foreign governments, this Los Angeles-based production company is developing a number of major international-themed projects for feature films, television, and interactive media. It is not known what foreign governments those might involve beyond Iran. Why the website was shut down is also unknown." Would Sushil Tyagi's international business ties ever influence Warren's decision-making? That is hard to know. What can be known is that his businesses could stand to benefit from her advocacy and proposed policies. One of Elizabeth Warren's themes about anti-competitive practices in corporate America involves her critique of the beer industry. "If you've bought a six-pack recently," she wrote in 2017, "chances are you're paying more for fewer options. That's because just two companies control the lion's share of America's beer, buying up the craft brewers and independent breweries that have created a vibrant beer market and jacking up beer prices in order to stuff more money into their own pockets." She has pushed federal regulators to go after large brewing companies. "The thing is, we already have laws that prevent companies from doing just that. It's time to start enforcing them. Antitrust agencies can start by telling aspiring monopolies, keep your hands off of our beer." Warren describes herself as a beer lover, but nowhere does she mention that Sushil Tyagi, her son-in-law, runs two beer-related enterprises. The first is an enterprise in India, Kali Gori Breweries in Uttarakhand province. The brewery name matches several business registrations in March 2011 under the name Kali Gori Breweries, both with Sushil's name on them. Tyagi had been seeking to open the business since at least 2009. In fact, he authorized a power of attorney describing the prospective business to an Indian attorney, possibly his brother. What makes that interesting is that the power of attorney was notarized in Los Angeles and witnessed by Elizabeth Warren and husband Bruce Mann. In December 2010, Tiagi registered another beer-related business, this time stateside in Delaware, but operated out of his California home. Called Craft Bev International Amalgamated, it appears to have no other employees or executives. Its only public footprint was its purchase of the legacy Celis beer brands in June 2012. In November 2013, Craft Bev sold for an undisclosed amount the domestic production rights for Celis to Total Beverage Solutions, a firm run by a former Guinness executive. Craft Bev retained the international distribution rights until February 2017, when the Celis family repurchased all trademark rights. By Tiagi's own statements at the time, he remains involved in the brand's international marketing. Warren has written over the years about her concerns that regulatory agencies would be captured by outside interests, with regulators no longer focused on the proper regulation, but instead doing the bidding of those outside interests. Cleary Gottlieb was at the center of the effort to fight against the creation of Warren's new bureau. Cleary Gottlieb served as the lobbyists for a host of financial firms looking to weaken Dodd-Frank. This includes Barclays, Bank of America, Citigroup, Credit Suisse Group, Nomura Holdings, BNP Paribas, Credit Agricole Corporate and Investment, Deutsche Bank AG, and the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. Cleary Gottlieb was working behind the scenes to see that the new financial reform bill worked for the interests of their clients. It is important to note that Elizabeth Warren called out several institutions and individuals for trying to undermine the financial reforms. She took Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, Chair Mary Jo White to task, for example, calling her work extremely disappointing. Warren apparently held her fire and never publicly attacked or condemned Cleary Gottlieb, who funded her work at Harvard, or their clients. Ever since Warren had stepped onto the national stage in the Obama administration, powerful Democrats had been encouraging her to run for office. Senator Chuck Schumer and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid were early enthusiasts. An organization called the Progressive Change Campaign Committee set up a fundraising effort to draft her, so when she announced her Senate campaign in 2011, she had plenty of friends and allies. One of the most important was daughter Amelia, who had built up relationships within the progressive movement. In the early stages of the Democratic primary in Massachusetts, it was a crowded field. Several other candidates announced early for the run against Republican Senator Scott Brown. Meanwhile, the organization connected to Amelia quietly went about boosting her status inside the progressive movement. Amelia sat on the board of directors of a left-wing organization called Demos, becoming chairman in 2010. New York-based Demos had championed Elizabeth Warren to head up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, never disclosing that Amelia was chairing the organization. Demos now applauded her run for the Senate, calling her a figure of rare integrity and declaring, "She and this republic are better served by Warren making the Senate run." Miles Rapaport, then president of Demos, said in July 2011, "Demos has long been a vocal supporter of Elizabeth Warren and commends her for working tirelessly to set up the CFPB, all while defending it from unrelenting and unfounded attacks." In 2010, the group even presented her with a Transforming America Award. In their statement of praise, though, Demos never mentioned that her daughter Amelia was a board member and then chairman of the organization. Eventually, the other candidates for the Democratic primary bid melted away and Warren beat Republican incumbent Scott Brown. As Warren's political star rose, so would Amelia's business. Beginning in 2012 and 2013, shortly after Warren took her seat in the Senate, BTG began growing rapidly, according to a Stanford University Business School history of the company. Eventually, there was an interesting overlap between the clients that hired BTG and Senator Elizabeth Warren's legislative work. In 2014, Senator Elizabeth Warren pushed for more funding for the National Institutes of Health, or NIH. In 2015, her daughter's BTG landed a contract with the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health for $808,000. The following year, they received another for $467,000. Senator Elizabeth Warren sits on the Senate Health Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which has passed legislation providing funds for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds PBS. In 2015, the committee passed the Ready to Learn program to help fund PBS. Also in 2015, her daughter's firm began listing PBS as a client. BTG's list of clients generally overlaps with those who have matters sitting before Elizabeth Warren in the U.S. Senate, and she at times has appeared to take positions or actions that would benefit her daughter's clients. Consider Warren's attitude toward the medical device industry. Warren sits on the powerful Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, with oversight of the medical industry. Warren has consistently bashed other large industries for excessive profits and failure to pay their fair share in taxes. The most profitable corporations should have to pay their fair share, she says. While the medical device industry would certainly fit that definition, Warren has been very supportive of it. As a senator, she pushed for the repeal of the medical device taxes that were part of Obama's Affordable Care Act. She also introduced something called the Medical Innovation Act, which would take fines paid by the pharmaceutical industry and steer them for the benefit of med tech companies. Warren has also favored rewriting Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, rules for the benefit of med tech companies and wants certain tax credits made permanent for the industry. Observers have taken note of her wild inconsistencies when it comes to this one industry. One Democratic Senate staffer told Time magazine, "The idea that Elizabeth Warren thinks that one industry should get a sweetheart deal from paying their fair share for providing health care to poor Americans is repulsive." Observers note that several medical device manufacturers are based in Massachusetts. What no one mentions is the other significant tie between the medical device industry and Warren's family. Her daughter's firm has more than half a dozen medical device manufacturers as clients. The BTG client list includes two of the largest medical device companies, Johnson & Johnson and General Electric. It also lists as clients Emerson, Pfizer, McKesson, Hologic, and Hitachi, all of which are in the field affected by the medical device tax. The Carlyle Group, another BTG client, spent $4.15 billion to buy a medical device company, Ortho Clinical Diagnostics, in 2015. In short, the Warren family's legacy of deep financial ties to major corporations continues. It began with Warren's corporate legal work and now extends to providing staffing solutions to major corporations. Despite Warren's continued vocal criticism of corporate America, the family has prospered in its close association with the same. Likewise, Warren's political campaigns have been fueled by campaign donations from major corporate law firms who represent the Wall Street firms and the major corporations that she often criticizes. Warren has three entities collecting campaign contributions while she serves in the Senate. She had a campaign committee, a leadership PAC named PAC for a Level Playing Field, and a joint fundraising committee called the Elizabeth Warren Action Fund. Each received large contributions from white-collar criminal defense and financial industry law firms, as well as individuals working in the private equity and securities and investment industries. Lawyers and law firms are together the largest group of contributors to the Action Fund. Included contributions are sizable checks from Brown Rudnick, Kochet, Petrie, and McCarthy, and others. Her campaign committee funds for the Senate reflect a similar story. Indeed, for her first election in 2012, among her top contributions were high-powered white-collar criminal defense and financial attorneys at Ropes and Gray and at Goodwin and Procter. There were other conflicting relationships, too. Elizabeth Warren describes her close relationship with Richard Trumka, who would become president of the AFL-CIO. During her days at the TARP Commission, she describes an encounter with him. Trumka recalls, "She doesn't see me, and I lean up and I say to her, 'Don't worry, Elizabeth, I have your back.' And she turned around and smiled and said, 'Yes, you do, and I'll always have the back of the workers.'" At the same time, Trumka's union was a donor to Amelia's organization, Demos. As a United States Senator, Elizabeth Warren advocated for projects that were of interest to those corporate law firms to which she was closest. These projects would seem to contradict her stated positions on important issues. In 2018, Warren co-sponsored the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Reservation Reaffirmation Act, which would overturn a federal court decision and allow the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe in Massachusetts to open a casino. The idea of allowing the tribe to open the casino was rather odd, in part because it was new, first recognized by the federal government in 2007 after a vigorous lobbying effort that included Washington super lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who later went to prison on fraud and bribery charges. The tribe was also small. It had roughly 2,600 members. The tribe wanted to open a casino called First Light Casino and Resort in the blue-collar town of Taunton, Massachusetts. What was most unusual about the project was Warren's support for it. Going back to 2012, she had consistently taken the position of opposing legalized gambling in Massachusetts. In 2014, she supported efforts to repeal legalized gambling in Massachusetts. It's a tough call here. People need jobs, but gambling can be a real problem economically for a lot of people, she said. I didn't support gambling the first time around, and I don't expect to support it now. The Mashpee Wampanoag Casino ran into legal problems in 2016 when U.S. District Judge William G. Young halted the tribe's plans for the casino. Judge Young blocked the Department of Interior's decision to take land into trust on behalf of the tribe, which was a prerequisite for Indian gaming. But in 2018, Elizabeth Warren completely reversed her long-held position by supporting legislation to overturn the federal court's decision. Her support for the repeal was also unusual in that the town where it was to be built was largely opposed to the Mashpee Wampanoag Casino project. Mayor William Carpenter of nearby Brockton actually went to Washington to meet with lawmakers to oppose the bill. The proposed casino would destroy his community's own plans for a casino. In short, Warren had long opposed Massachusetts' desire for casinos providing blue-collar jobs, but now appeared in favor of one for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. Warren's move puzzled most observers, who assumed that she reversed course on the issue of gambling in an effort to heal her relationship with Native Americans after the fallout over her bogus claims of Native American ancestry. Other reasons might also explain why she would support the deal. The First Light Casino and Resort was to be on Mashpee Wampanoag tribal land, but running the casino and vacuuming up 40% of the gross profits was a massive Malaysian gambling conglomerate called Genting. The Malaysian company had already reportedly sunk $400 million into the deal. In short, they stood to lose a lot. Representing Genting in the Mashpee Wampanoag Casino deal was Cleary Gottlieb. In fact, the law firm was extremely close to Genting, representing the Malaysian company in several deals, including the financing of a $3 billion casino in Las Vegas, as well as projects in New York City and Miami. Elizabeth Warren's efforts to leverage her positions for her own financial and political benefit are not unusual. As we will see in the next chapter, one of her closest Senate colleagues has been doing so for decades. 6. Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown has always relied on a certain roguish charm when in the public spotlight. Described by the media as a handsome, gravelly-voiced defender of the working class, perpetually mentioned in presidential conversations, he has spent almost his entire adult life either serving in political office or running for it. The unique appeal to his supporters, in addition to that charm, is the fact that he viewed himself as a progressive before it was cool. While most progressives on the national stage hail from the coasts, think California, Oregon, Massachusetts, or New York, Ohio-born Sherrod Brown has his feet firmly planted in the American heartland. Brown carries with him all the accessories of a Midwestern populist. He speaks of hard-hewn Midwestern values and his Lutheran faith. Chapter 25 in the Bible's Book of Matthew features prominently in his speeches and interviews, normally translated to indicate Jesus' kudos for those who have served the least of these. He takes umbrage at the least language, so he reads a version called the Justice and Poverty Bible, which apparently translates more to his egalitarian liking. Brown is, in many respects, a throwback. As one writer puts it, he often seemed a politician from the radio era. Brown loves telling reporters that he wears suits made just 10 miles from his house in Cleveland, and, of course, he drives an American-made Jeep. Brown does not dress like the typical U.S. senator. His perpetually wrinkled suits and shaggy hair are standard on the campaign trail or behind the podium. Brown displays his working-class sentiments in his Senate office reception area, where he has a minor safety lamp sitting on the table, as well as a beer stein from the United Mine Workers. On the wall, there is a plaque of a caged canary. In earlier times, miners used the birds to detect toxic air in the mine. Brown's progressive message has been consistent over the nearly 50 years he has been in political office. He is a fighter for the working class. It has been a 100-year battle between the privileged and the rest of us, he thunders like an Old Testament prophet. Brown's supporters and family express his political work in heroic terms. His wife, Connie Schultz, once sent an email to a colleague at the Cleveland Plain Dealer who had drawn a political cartoon critical of him. She wrote, "For 30 years, Sherrod has fought for those who would have no voice and no future without him, and he remains a hero to so many, especially to me." But Brown himself, as we will see, grew up privileged. While he has campaigned with a hole in one shoe and drawn the media's attention to it with an early infamous re-election advertisement, his roots are far from working class. His identification with workers has more to do with his reading material than actual